All right, we're beginning on the top of Kuf Aleph Amud Aleph by the two dots. Shataf Nahar Zeitav. If the river comes along, overflows, washes away his olive trees and deposits the whole tree in his friend's field, and then they have a disagreement as to who is entitled to the output, to the produce of this tree, because it left the field of one individual, but now it's sitting in the field of the other individual. So you have two questions. One is, can he take the trees back? And number two is, if the trees remain there, who's entitled to the output, to the olives that come from it? So, Amar Ula, Amar Reish Lakish, Lo Shanu El Shenekru Bigushehem Ula Achar Shalosh. So there are two pieces to Reish Lakish's statement. One is, this is only true if the trees were taken with the dirt that would allow them to grow. And number two is, after 3 years. Tosafot clearly connects Shenekru Bigushehem to the Din of Orla. The din of Orla is that in the first 3 years of a fruit tree's growth, you're not entitled to take any of the produce. It's asur b'achila, asur b'hana'a. In the fourth year, it is netar rivai, which is that it has the same din as maaser sheni, needs to be brought up to Yerushalayim and eaten in Yerushalayim or redeemed. In the fifth year, it belongs to you. But for the first 3 years, the fruits are worthless in a sense because you can't eat them. There is a din by Orla that if a tree moves with a sufficient amount of earth, that it could continue to live in that clod of earth that goes with it, then it's not reset in terms of Orla. So if you move a tree from one side of your garden to the other side of your garden, if you uproot enough earth that it could survive in that earth, then it doesn't get a reset for Orla. So what the Balei Tosafot say, that this issue of Shenekru Bigushehem is connected to that issue of Orla. Because if they went without the earth, then they'd be reset and they'd become Asurim. And we'll see in a second why that has implications in terms of their splitting. The Rambam, on the other hand, you can see in the Gra, does not connect the two issues and seems to say that Gushehem is connected to the Choshen Mishpat issues, which we're about to discuss, nothing to do with Orla. In terms of moving a tree, if you uproot a tree and move it from the, for instance, the nursery, and bring it to your house and plant it, what is the din as far as resetting Orla? So from this Gemara, as well as the Mishnayot, it would seem that if it moves with sufficient earth on it, then it would not be reset when you get there. There are deot, that that's only true when the earth itself that is attached to the tree is what's called ru'ei pnei adama. It always still sees the ground, meaning that there's nothing separating between it and the ground. That has to do with a view in Chazal that even if something is detached or above the ground, it still sustains itself from the ground, and it's as if it's not ne'akar min hakarka. So therefore, those people believe if you put the tree on the back of a flatbed and then haul it over to the house and plant it, you would get a reset for Orla. Since Orla is a din de'oraita, generally, when we have a safek in Orla, we say safek the chumra. And so therefore, most cases, when a tree is ne'ekar, you have two problems when it's bought from the nursery. First of all, is the trustworthiness of the individual who planted it to tell you how many years it's grown already. Because, do they have ne'amanut? Do they not have ne'amanut? They are nogea b'davar, number one. And many times, they may not be shomrei Torah v'mitzvot. And so you have a question as to whether they have ne'amanut with regards to the age of the tree. The second problem you have is whether you're choshesh for this shita with regards to having it separate from the ground, and then you would have a reset of the 3 years. That's with regards to the din of Orla. So now, what he says here, after 3 years, then there's this issue as to who the produce belongs to, and that's what our Mishnah addresses and says they split it. Aval b'toch shalosh, within the first 3 years, akol shel bal hazeitim. It all belongs to the tree owner, da'amalei, because he would say to him, I at natat b'toch shalosh. Had you planted it within the first 3 years, mi'avachalt, you wouldn't have eaten anyway. So the fact that these trees are in your property, had you started fresh and planted trees in your property, you still wouldn't have been able to eat them for the first 3 years. So for the first 3 years, I should garner all the olives that come off of here. Afterwards, we split it because it's my tree, your ground, and we'll split it between us. Gemara says, v'lei malei, the individual whose land it is can say back to the tree owner, Iana Natai, if I had planted it, Lachar Shalosh Shavachinu Lei Kulei. He says, had I planted it, you're right, for the first 3 years I would have garnered nothing, But after those 3 years, I would have gotten everything. Hashta kachalt palgo behadai. Now you're eating half with me, or hashta tochal palgo behadai, or now you will eat together with me after their first 3 years. And so it doesn't make sense. He has some sort of negotiating leverage, which says that after 3 years, I would have had 100%. The fact that you're keeping 50% after that should entitle me at least to 50% before the 3 years come up, because it's unfair that you're taking the back end if I don't get anything in the front end. Ella, Kiaza Rabin, Amar Reish Lakish. So here we have an alternate view of Reish Lakish. Rabin, Ula, Rav Dimi are individuals who traveled between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, and they bring back Memrot from the Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael. So over here you have a Memra from Reish Lakish, and here you have Ula and Rabin bringing back different versions of what Reish Lakish says. So here, Kiata Rabin Amar Reish Lakish, Lo Shano Lashenekru Bigushehem Ubetoch Shalosh. Our Mishnah is only true when they are uprooted with the earth that they are planted in, Ubetoch Shalosh, within the first 3 years. Meaning that's when the Mishnah is relevant and they split the produce between them in the first 3 years. Aval da'achar shalosh, hakol lebala karko. After 3 years, it all belongs to the owner of the field. Damar lei, because he has a claim that can say, I ananatai, had I planted it, la'achar shalosh, milava achilno lei kule. I would have eaten everything. After 3 years, it would all belong to me. So after 3 years, there's no question that I should be entitled to all the produce here. V'lei malei, why doesn't the owner of the tree say back to him, I'at natat betoch shalosh, had you planted within the first 3 years, lo v'achalt, you wouldn't have eaten anything. Hashka ka'achalt palga b'hadai. Now you're getting 50% in the first 3 years, something that you would have gotten had you planted on your own. So that doesn't work because the owner of the land can say back to him, Mishum damalei, i'ana natai, had I planted the trees, have a katina, I would have taken saplings and planted them and they would have been small. And in the area around them, I could have planted selek and yerek, that's beets and other vegetables that shade is helpful for, but I could have planted around them. Now that your trees are here, they're much bigger. So I would have started with small saplings. In the first 3 years, they wouldn't have taken up so much space and I could have planted more in the field. Now that you or trees came, fully mature trees, ended up on my land, then I lost plantable or fertile area in the land and I can't plant as much. So even though, yes, I'm gaining by the fact that I'm allowed to eat 50% in the first 3 years, I'm losing in the productivity of my field. So that's the offset. After 3 years, I would have garnered 100% if it was my tree. So for your tree too, I should garner 100%. Now that seems unfair because the tree belongs to the original owner. So Tosafot qualifies that over here. And says, Afa pi shalachar gimel akol shel balakarka. Even though after 3 years everything belongs to the balakarka, ubalakarka itain demei zeitim kemo sheshavim limkor l'nitiot. He has to pay him as if he purchased them as saplings. Velo sagi b'demei zeitim. He can't just pay him for the wood value of the trees. Shelasot peirot tein omdim. These are productive trees that are going to produce fruits. They're not there for their wood purposes. They're there for their fruit purposes. So in the end, the balakarka does have to compensate the balazetim. He compensates them for the equivalent of what it would cost him to purchase the saplings to plant in his land. And then he'll get 50%, and the other one will get 50% for those first 3 years. After that point, it will all belong to the balakarka. But that's because he paid for the saplings. In the interim, the owner of the original saplings or trees can then take that money that he had gotten, plant new saplings, and by the time the 3 years expire, then he should be able to garner fruits from his own field as well. So that is the din that comes out of our Mishnah. So even though our Mishnah itself made no distinction between before 3 years and after 3 years, here we have an imposition of the Amoraim dealing with the Mishnah and saying that this ability to split it because of the claims of the two parties, equal claims of the two parties, is only true in the first 3 years. After 3 years, the claims favor the balakarka heavily, and therefore he will garner all the production. So Tana, Amar Hala Zeitai Ani Notel. If the individual says, I want my trees back, so he says, forget this whole deal of splitting it. I'm just going to take my trees back and put them back in my land. Ein Shomim Lo. We do not listen to him. He does not have a right to take his trees back. Now that is surprising because they are his trees. It was a natural event or disaster that moved them from his property to the other property. Why shouldn't he be able to take his trees back? My time, why is that the case? Am Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It's because of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, which now Rabbi Yirmiya says, Am Rabbi Yirmiya Kon Da Tzricha Rabba. For something like this, we need a big gun like Rabbi Yochanan. Because had it not been for Rabbi Yochanan, either we would never have said something like this, or we wouldn't have imposed a knas of some sort. It's almost a penalty here in order to preserve Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And that is that when it comes to trees that are planted in Eretz Yisrael, we don't want to uproot trees that exist on land. So it's here that the trees moved from his land to the other property. Now he has trees in the other property. His property, yes, is missing trees, but if he wants to replace them, he will plant more trees. So that then facilitates greater Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, you would think about in terms of housing, in terms of ability to live, and that's exactly what is being said here. The ability to have a livelihood and the ability to have productive trees and fertile land is a part and parcel of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is not simply landing and sitting on the land. It means to live, literally, on the land, to be able to sustain yourself and vent parnosa on the land. So therefore, these trees that move to the other property, we're not going to uproot them because now the original property will plant again, and now we'll have more production in general with regards to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. That would imply that maybe if the trees were not fruit-producing trees, that the din would be different. Although you could argue that the mere planting of the trees has a value in terms of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, whether it's for their wood or for their shade, for the general quality of life that's in Eretz Yisrael, maybe the din should apply even if it's not fruit trees in Eretz Yisrael. There is a daya brought in the Me'iri that this din is not about Eretz Yisrael, interestingly enough, but rather it's a din that has to do with property of Yisrael. So not Eretz Yisrael, but Aratzot Shel Yisrael. Lands are Jewish lands, which means that any time that Jewish lands are subject to this din, then we want to have them have a good setup or a good situation. And therefore the trees move. We're not okir them because of the fact that this will lead to a better settlement of the Jews, probably relying on the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu that says to the Jews who are being taken to Bavel, that you should set up good houses and a nice life here because you're going to be here for a little while. And so that there's an imperative that when you go and live in the Galut, that you settle down and live a proper life and not that you are always in a difficult situation. It seems to me it's a far-fetched position, but there is a position like that that's brought by the Me'iri and the Shita Mekubetzet that says such a thing. And most of the poskim take this to literally mean Eretz Yisrael. It makes sense that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is paramount, and therefore the trees here facilitate that ability of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It's not autumn. There's a Mishnah over there. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, HaMekabel Stei Avutav Min HaNachri. Someone who takes as a sharecropper property from a Nachri, Stei Avutav means the property of his forefathers. We'll see in a second what that means. Me'aser V'notenlo. He has to first take off Masrot and then pay the Nachri. Savrua. You know right away, if the Gemara says Savrua, this is what we thought. That means that the Gemara now is going to propose a number of assumptions. And obviously you can undermine this by undermining or taking away any one of the assumptions. But here the Gemara lays out the assumptions. Savrua, my Stei Avutav. First of all, what is the meaning of Stei Avutav? Eretz Yisrael means the land of Israel. But my karulei Stei Avutav. So why is it called the fields or the land of his forefathers? Stei Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Because these are the lands or the fields of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So that's what it means, Stei Avutav. That's the first assumption. Second assumption. Because Zavar, Ein Kinyan HaNachri, Be'eretz Yisrael, Efkia Miyad Maser. The second assumption is that a Nochri's ownership does not then free you from the necessity to take off Shumot and Masrot in Eretz Yisrael. This has implications in two matters. The first one of which is that, obviously the Nachri himself is not Chayav in Shumot or Masrot. But a Jew that is working that land then will be chayav in Trumot Masrot. Maybe only Darabanan, but he definitely will be chayav in Trumot Masrot, because the Nachri's ownership is not sufficient grounds to negate the necessity or the Kedushat Haaretz that requires the Afreshat Trumot Masrot. The second implication is if a Jew buys it back from the Nachri, the Jew who buys it then is then subject to Trumot Masrot. If the opposite was true, which is that there was a kinyan for Nachri, Afkia Masrot, Be'eretz Yisrael, or Afkia Kedusha, Shel Eretz Yisrael, number one would be that there would be no obligation to take off Trumot and Masrot, even if you were working his land, because it's his ownership. Now, Midrabanan, again, you might be Chayav in Trumot Masrot, we'll see reasons as to why, maybe. But Mina Torah, clearly you would not be Chayav. The second thing is, if a Jew then bought the property from the Nachri, it would not be a continuation of Kedushat Haaretz, because the Kedushat Haaretz was Nifsak, the ownership of the Nachri. And then when the Jew acquires it, it's almost like a Kibush Chadash. It's as if he reconquered or reacquired the land. That reacquisition of the land would not obligate him in Kedushat Haaretz or Trumot and Masrot. So this has implications from two sides. One, again, is whether there's an obligation while the Nachri owns the land. And secondly, there's a question as to after a Jew reacquires it from the Nachri, what is the din of the land in that situation? This has major nafkumino today with regards to Heter Mechira, with regards to Shemitah, meaning that does the selling of the land to the Nachri do anything? Obviously, it's dependent on this concept or this halacha of whether there's a kinyan Nachri Be'etzel of Kia, that he has a right through his ownership to change the dynamic of the Kedushat Haaretz, or to negate the necessity to deal with Kedushat Haaretz. There, obviously, there's no restriction against him working the land, but does his ownership then mafkia the need for Shemitah, and therefore the produce of that land is not considered to be Shemitah produce? If he doesn't have that type of kinyan or ownership, then the produce remains Shemitah produce because it grew through Kedushat Haaretz. So that's one of the issues that obviously comes up as to the efficacy of Heter Mechira, is whether the Nachri's ownership is sufficient to overcome the problem. But once you do that, then the Heter Mechira becomes much more problematic. It might be that it also can disconnect the two. It might be that Shemitah derives from the land itself, whereas Trumot Masrot might derive from the ownership. You may be able to have Trumot Masrot be disconnected from the Shemitah issue. There are ways to separate it, meaning that the din might be different with Shemitah versus Trumot Masrot. The Rambam has something akin to that, where he has a different halacha with regards to Shemitah and Trumot Masrot. The third assumption here is Mikabel Kechocher Dami. There are two ways to be a sharecropper on a field. There is a Mikabel, which in the parlance of the Mishnah is an Aris. An Aris is someone who works the land as a sharecropper for a percentage of the output of the land. He shares in the output of the land with the balabayit. He gets a percentage, the balabayit gets a percentage. A chocher, on the other hand, is a sharecropper that works for a fixed fee of produce every year. It doesn't have anything to do with the produce of the land, how productive the land is. He's basically renting the land, but he's renting the land not for cash, but rather for produce. So he's able to pay it with the output of the land and not with cash. But if there is no output to the land, he's still chayav to pay for it. The difference would be that the obligation of a chocher is a debt that is outstanding. It's a rental obligation that he's going to pay irrespective of the production of the land. Another, an emikabel, an aris, is only subject to a fee based on the percentage. It's a sharing of the output of the land. So sharing of the risk, but sharing of the output as well. The difference will be whether there's an outstanding obligation over here. And that is because one is not allowed to discharge their obligation with tevel. If you have an outstanding obligation, you can't pay the person back with tevel, because that means you're utilizing tevel for your benefit to pay off debts instead of using your own produce. So that would be the difference here. The Gemara makes an assumption here that an aris should be like a choker, that just like a choker has a fixed fee payment every year, which means that he's indebted, machocher ben avad ben lovad bayasure umitanle. A chocher who's paying a fixed rental fee, whether he worked the field, whether he doesn't work the field, he's got to take off masrot and then pay it off. Dechi poreya chavoto dami, because it's the equivalent of discharging a obligation or a loan. Af mikabel nami. Now, this would not have been the logical way to look at this. If you look at a sharecropper, you would have assumed that the sharecropper's share belongs to him. The share of the Baal HaBayit belongs to the Baal HaBayit from the start. And therefore, the sharecropper, when he hands over the parts of the Baal HaBayit, is handing the Baal HaBayit his own produce. He's not discharging an obligation or a chov. They're simply splitting it, and this belongs to the sharecropper, this belongs to the Baal HaBayit. There's no paying up. Each one would have to take for themselves. Each one has to take their own shumot ha-masrot off. But the Gemara here is saying that there's an assumption that the mikabel, the aritz, has the same din as a chocher. And therefore, when he pays the Baal HaBayit, kiporeh chavotov dami, it is the similar to discharging an obligation, ma'aser v'notelo, and therefore he would have to take off ma'aser first, and then only then pay it off. Now that is a very difficult assumption. The way Rashi reads the Gemara over here is that the Gemara has three assumptions in the Gemara. The first assumption is it's talking about Eretz Yisrael. Number two is that ein kinyan l'nachrid l'afkiach tusha. And number three is that we're going to assume that a aris has the same din as a chocher. That's Rashi's view. The Baal HaTosafot disagree, and you can see that the Ri says, near the Ri Lefresh, kasavar ein kinyan u'mikabel kechocher. The two are connected. That means that if there's no kinyan for an achri be'eretz Yisrael, then we're going to treat an aris kechocher. If he does not have the ability to take away the kedusha, then we're going to say that an aris has the same din as a chocher. The other way around, if you believe that he does have a ability to be mafkia, then we would not be machmir to say that aris has the din of a chocher. He connects the two items together, and he explains why, because we have reason to be machmir on the Jew in that case. If the Nachri doesn't have the ability to remove the Kedusha, that means that the Kedusha is still extant. If that's the case, we'd prefer a Jew to be on there than a non-Jew, and so therefore we're going to, in a sense, penalize the Aris for working the land, and again, we'll see in a second why that might be, and therefore we're going to treat him like a chocher, treat him like a renter rather than a sharecropper. Where the chocher has to be mafrish trumot masrot midoraita. Therefore, the Rabbanan also instituted that the mikabel, the aris, has to do the same. On the other hand, if the nachri has a kinyan to be mafkia the kedusha, then the kedusha is already removed, and therefore there's no reason to penalize the aris for taking up the property as a sharecropper and treating him like a chocher. Since the chocher is only paying midrabanan, similar to a purchaser of the crops from a nochri, so they're not going to be machmir, the gabe, the mekabel, the aris, that he should also have to be mafrish, trumot, and masrot. So that's the way that the Baal HaTosafot to argue on Rashi and see this as one reason, not two separate reasons. He sees them as being connected, or one is the result of the other. There's a two more dayot. There's the day of the Rabbeinu Tam, which the Tosafot brings at the end and rejects. But there is also a day of the Ran and others that suggest that the difference might relate to whether this guy is a metzik or not a metzik, which is that, how did he come into control of the property? Did he get the property legally, and then he purchased it and he owns it? That's a nachri, that's one way. Or there is a metzik, which is someone who confiscated or stole or strong-armed the property away from the other party. In that case, even if you believe that there is a din of a nachri to be mafkia dusha, in this case, he may not be able to be mafkia kedusha because he doesn't have legal rights to the field. He stole the field. It's not his. And so therefore, in that case, we say aris kechocher. That we say that the aris is like a chocher because otherwise the property would be chayav in trumot and masrot because the kedusha would still exist. So they narrow what the Tosafot are saying to a smaller subset of cases. Not every time are the two connected. But in the specific case where it is a metzik, a person who stole the property or confiscated the property, in those situations, since the kinyan is not relevant anymore because he doesn't have a kinyan, therefore we then introduce the second piece, which is the mikabel kechocher dummy, that we treat the mikabel kechocher. Now, amarle Rav Kana the Rav Papi, amarle Rav Zvid, elahad etanya. The problem is now that Rabbi Yehuda's shita is not consistent over here, which is Rabbi Yehuda Omer, HaMekabel Shtei Avotav MiMetzik Nachri, person who gets Shtei Avotav from a strong-armed marauder, someone who's stealing and confiscating property, Me'aser V'Notein Lo. He has to take off Masrot and give it to him. My Iria Metzik. According to you, why is this din unique to a Metzik? Afilu Ein Metzik Nami. Even if it was a normal transaction, according to you, these dinim apply based on what we said from the Mishnah before. Elo Olam must have to say, Yesh kinyan l'nachri b'eretz Yisrael l'afkia miyad maser, that there is an ability for a goy to be mafkia kedushat aretz. Umikabel lav kichocher dami. And an aris does not have a din like a renter. According to Rashi, those are two different pieces. According to the Ri, one is a result of the other. So therefore, since there is a kinyan for the Nachri Beretz Yisrael, therefore Mikabel is not kichocher dami according to the Ri. And according to the Ran, it's unique but special to this case over here by the Metzik, there might be a difference or an afkamina. Umay stei abutav. What is stei abutav? Stei abutav mamash. Doesn't mean Eretz Yisrael. It means really the property of his forefathers. Uludedei hu dekansu rabbonon. The rabbonon were kones him, which is that they penalized him. Da'ayde dechavivi alei tvei, ba'azil umikabolo. That since he wants the property back, he has a certain kinship with this property, he's going to take it. Despite the fact that you are charging him extra in terms of Trumot and Masrot, he's going to take it. Aval inish da'alma, lo. But a normal person would not accept these terms. What did he do wrong here that they're penalizing him? So here you have a machloket in the Rishonim as to how to explain the word bara. The word bara can either come from or derive from the word brura, which means clear, or it can derive from the word bur, which means to lay fallow. So the question is, which of those two are we trying to facilitate over here? The way Rashi and the Balei Tosafot bring a similar pshat is that Sheit Purab Yado is we want him to purchase the property. We want him to buy back the property. From this, most assume, again, that we're speaking about here, Eretz Yisrael, and Steil Vutav means his forefather's property, literally within Eretz Yisrael. Again, you have that Shita within the Shita Megubetz that brings the Meiri that suggests that it means any Jewish property. But assuming that it's talking about Eretz Yisrael, we want to encourage the Jew to own or repurchase his property. So how do we facilitate that? The way that the Rishonim, like Rashi and the Balei Tosfot say, Sheibu Rabbi Yado, is we want him to repurchase it from the Nachri. How do we do that? We burden him with the extra Trumot and Masrot that he's going to have to remove from the property. So therefore, it's going to cost him more to work the property. So you're going to say, if it costs him more to work the property, he's going to walk away. That's true of anyone else. Anyone else would walk away because they're not going to pay up the extra Trumot and Masrot. He, because he has a kinship with the property, and it was his forefather's property, will work the property despite the extra expense. But then the extra expense, over time, will eat away at him, and therefore he will try to buy it. So it's an incentive or a penalty to try to force him to purchase the property rather than to work on it as a sharecropper. That's the way they're actually in Tosafot. The Rabbeinu Hananel says, Shetei Barabi Adol, says that it's a reason for us to cause it to be fallow. We want the Nachri to be compelled to sell the field. So the penalty has to be placed on the person whose family's fields it is, because they would accept the field, despite the fact that Chazal say, don't take a field as a sharecropper from the Nachri. Chazal want the Nachri's property to lay fallow. If it lays fallow, he's going to sell it because he doesn't have the wherewithal to work it, he has nobody's willing to work it, and he'll sell it. He'll sell it at a cheap price, because in the end, he stole it anyway. He got it at a very low price. And even if he bought it, he probably also bought it at a lower price. And therefore, the repurchase of the property will be done at a discounted price. And that will encourage the exchange of hands or ownership here in Eretz Yisrael. But that will only happen if people listen to Chazal or listen to the fact that they shouldn't be planting the land. So as far as other people are concerned, they have no particular personal or emotional attachment to the land. We say, don't work the land. They're not going to work the land. The individual whose family's property it was has that kinship where he may not listen to what Chazal say. Therefore, they impose on him a higher penalty, which is, if you do go ahead and do it as a sharecropper, you will be responsible for paying the Trumot and Masrot on the entire field. In that way, we can force him or compel him to not want to work the field and leave it fallow, and then cause the Nachri to sell it. So those are two versions. Who are we trying to compel over here? Going to Rashi and the Balei Tosafot, we're trying to compel the person whose family's property it is to buy the property by causing him more costs for staying on the property, and that will incentivize him to buy the property. And the version of the Rabbeinu Hananel that it remains fallow, we're trying to incentivize the Nachri to sell, and we're trying to disincentivize the individual whose family's property is from working the land so it does remain fallow and cause the Nachri to sell it. So therefore, again, here you have Rabbi Yochanan giving us a reason for a knas. And Rabbi Yirmiya makes the same comment over here. Rabbi Yirmiya gondah tzricha rabo. For something like this, we need a big gun like Rabbi Yochanan to explain to us. Again, something that seems illogical, as well as the fact that he's imposing a knas that we want people to abide by. So you need a big gun to put a knas like that in place. Again, the Gemara that we just brought here is not necessarily connected to the previous case or to our Mishnah. It's just that it has Rabbi Yirmiya's statement on a position of Rabbi Yochanan with regards to a knas that says the same thing. And therefore, the Gemara brought it down because of that connection, not necessarily because there's a topical connection between these two parts of the Gemara. And so therefore, the explanation here of Steh Abutav means his family's property. The Nachri does have the ability to Mamafkia, and a Mekabel and Aris does not have an obligation, and therefore he would not be obligated to pay Trumot Masrot to give over the produce to the Nachri. The only reason we're doing that is it's a penalty on the individual whose land it was from their family in order to facilitate an exchange of the property, whether according to Rashi and the Tosafot or the Rabbeinu Hanano, based on their different views of to what the word bara means. So now the Gemara says, Itmar, hayurei detoks de chaviro vinata. Person goes down into his friend's field and plants saplings in his friend's field. Shelo birshut. Never got permission, never asked anything. Somebody goes in your backyard and plants a bunch of trees in your backyard. Amarav shaminlo. We assess the value of what is here. Viado ala tachtona. And he has the lower hand, meaning, this as Rashi explains, what we've seen this before in the Mishnah as well, he pays the lower of cost or benefit from the trees. Ushmol amar, omdim kama adam rotze litein besadezu lenota. We look at how much somebody would pay for a gardener to come along and put in the saplings into the field. Amar abba, velo plige. They do not argue. Kan besadeh asuyalita. Shmuel's statement is in a field where it's made for trees. It makes sense to have trees there. There you would pay for the gardener to come in and put in trees. So this other person did it. You'll pay him for that service. Kan besadeh sheinu asuyalita. Rav's statement is in a case where it's a field that wasn't necessarily ready to be planted or was going to be planted or was good for planting. And despite the fact he planted it, and then based on that, we're going to assess that he either has to pay the cost or the benefit, whichever is lower in that case. Vahadarav la beferush itmar, ela michlola itmar. Rav's position here was not explicit, but rather implicit. There's some that say that Rav Papa's position explaining Rav was not explicit, but rather implicit, and that is, da'o da'ata the kamei d'Rav. There was an individual came before Rav, amalei zil shumle. The individual came and said, another individual came in and planted all the stuff in my field. Rav says to him, go pay him. Assess what the value is of what he did, and then pay him. Amalei lo bina, says, I don't want it. I had no interest in this being done to my field. I don't want to pay the money. So this is a basic problem with all of this, which is somebody does you quote-unquote a favor, but you had no interest in the favor, and you had no interest in putting out the money. Now all of a sudden we're demanding that you pay him for something that you may not have done. So this guy says, I didn't want it. Amalei zum shumle. Again, he says back to him, go and assess the value via dola tachtona. This is what we learned from Rav. That Rav says that this is a situation in which we're not asking you to assess the value of the property and pay him for the full value. We're saying that you assess the value and determine what the cost was or the benefit. Whichever is lower, then you'll pay it. So he explains himself or clarifies himself, and that is the position of Rav. Amalei lo beina. He said, again, I have no interest in this. I didn't want him to plant it there. I don't want to pay for it. The sof chazia de gadra become mintarla. In the end, he put a fence around the field, and he was guarding it. He wouldn't let anybody into the field to take any of the fruits. Amalei galita datech de nechalach. It's very clear that you did want this, because now you're protecting it and taking the benefit from it. Zil shumle viado al yona. Go pay him, and he has the upper hand. Obviously, Rav over here was, in a sense, penalizing him for that. But from this, you have two inferences. One is the first thing, that Rav's position is yado al tachtona. Number two is that Rav Papa's din is true. Because where does Rav say yado al tachtona? That's in a case where he wasn't interested or was a field that wasn't ripe for this type of planting. But if he demonstrates or he wants something like this, then the din is like Shmuel, you assess it at the full value. Now the Rosh speaks about this issue because it's a very difficult issue. The fact that we are compelling someone to pay for something that they did not necessarily ask for. Now, yes, in this case, the individual on the back end showed his interest in it, and therefore we demand that he pays for it. But what happens if a person really doesn't want this here? What are we compelling him? What is the story with this guy who came in and planted all this stuff in his field? What do we do with that? So the Rosh in Ot Chav Bet discusses this and says, Im einu rotze lekaimam, if he has no interest in maintaining these trees here, Omer ler kach netiotecha, you can say to him, take your saplings, velech, and take it out of here. Afilu b'steh ha'osuyalita, even if it's a field that is ripe for planting, would be planted, but he has a right to tell him to take it out. The fish yacholomar lididi nechalit fei b'steh lavan. I'd rather have this field produce grains and not trees. The balabite has an option. So amrlei zil shum levi adua tachtenu. For yovem mifarshim katvu to said that she'ena suyalita havi. Most people explained here that the case here was a case where it was not a field that was ripe for planting. But lo nehirali, I don't think that's true. Chada de kamar le rab mitzchila zil shumle, the fact that Rab up front told him to go pay for it, akor chachach shumle v'yado ala tachtona kamar, kevin dena ena suyalita. Im kain, my hadar, tu kamar le zil shumle v'yado ala tachtona. So then why did he repeat afterwards that, go pay him and yado ala tachtona? Hagvar male halchi, that's what he said in the first place. V'o di sade shenu suyalita havai, even though he put the fence around it and he indicated he wanted it, it shouldn't be Yadola al Yona. Because the Elo Bai Balasadeba Anachtiot, Elome Yishli Nitot Arbeya Nitzrichlis Devan. Because you could say, I have plenty of trees. I don't need more trees. I needed a grain field. Even in a field that is made for planting, I think the Rosh says that you can tell him to take his plants and get them out of here. I want to take them out and plant grains. Why should he have to pay for saplings and for planting when he has no interest whatsoever in what is being planted here? The only case where you have to pay is if he planted them. And the Baal Bayit says, well, now that you planted them, I want to keep them. Based on that, but nevertheless, even in that case, if it's a sadeh that's not made for planting of trees, he still has to pay the lower amount. So that's the chiddush. According to the Rosh, there are two chiddushim over here. First of all, you have a right of refusal. No matter what type of field you have a right to tell him, take it out. I have no interest in it. The second thing that you have, according to the Rosh, is that even if you say, I'm going to keep it, then in a field that is not made for planting of trees, you still only pay the lower of cost or value. It's not that once you accept it, then Shmuel's din kicks in. No, even if you accept it, it has to do with the nature of the field. Again, you could argue on the Rosh on two points. One point is the fact that once he's done it, maybe you don't have a right to be okeret. That might have to do with Rabbi Yochanan's din before, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Once something is planted there, then you may not have a right to uproot it. And yes, you might be compelled to pay for it. Number two is that even if you say like the Rosh, that you have a right to refuse, it might be that once you've accepted it, then Shmuel's din kicks in. Shmuel's din is if you wanted it, then you pay for the full amount. If you didn't want it, then you do like Rav, you pay the lower of cost or benefit. So the Rosh gives us two chidushim in that manner. And you can see the Pilpul Harifta over there on the Rosh notes that the Beit Yosef and others disagree with these conclusions of the Rosh. Where the Ramban says that if it is a field that is made for planting, you don't have a right to say to him, take your stuff out. And number two, in a field that's not made for planting, and the Balabait acquiesces to keep that which is there, the Ramban believes you have to pay him like Shmuel as a full-fledged field, Hasuyalita. Although the Beit Yosef says that the Ramban would agree in a situation where up front, the individual said that I'm going to accept the planting, even though it was an area that was not made for planting, that he would agree to the Rosh's position and say that Yadoa Tachtuna. And therefore, the incident with Rav was being at a case where it was a field that was not made for planting. And similar to Rashi, the Beit Yosef notes that once the individual showed that he wanted to keep the field, after originally had said he didn't want to keep the field, Asita Sadeh Asuyalita. He changes it into a field that is made for planting. And that's why the din is Yadoel El Yona. We have another case like this, similar to what we just spoke about, which is a Yireh Datoch Churvato Shel Chaveiro. person who descends into this area that is laying barren, an area where he used to have a house that was built there, and now it's left in ruins. Ubana shelo birshuto. He rebuilds the house, or whatever structure was there, without permission. Vamarlo, etzai vabanai anidotel. And after some time, he comes back and says, you know what? It was nice, I had this fun, I built this house, but all these stones and wood are mine. I'm going to take them back. You had nothing before that I built this thing. Now, I'm going to come and just take what I want back. Rav Nachman Meir shumim lo. Rav Nachman says, he has a right. He put effort and he invested in the property. The Baal Bayit never paid for it, so it's still his stuff. He can take his stuff back. Rav Sheshit Amar, in shumim lo. Rav Sheshit says, we don't listen to him. Meitave. Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer, Beit Shammai Omrim, shumim lo. Beit Shammai says, we listen to him. Beit Hillel Omrim, in shumim lo. Beit Hillel says, we don't listen. Lema. That would make it that Rav Nachman Damar ke Beit Shammai. How could it be that Rav Nachman is aligning his position with that of Beit Shammai? Rav Nachman says, shumim lo, just like Beit Shammai says. And that would be strange, because Rav Nachman usually in dinim, the loch is kemoto, but Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, the loch is ke Beit Hillel. So why would Rav Nachman be aligning himself with Beit Shammai? Hu damar ki aitano. Now Rav Nachman looks at the braita in the following manner. Tanya, shumim lo, dibi Rabbi Shimon Elazar. Shimon Elazar says that it's a stam. Everybody agrees, shumim lo. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer, Beit Shammai omrim shumim lo, Beit Hillel omrim ein shumim lo. So it's only Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel who says there is a machloket over here, whereas Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says it's divrei akol shumim lo, and Rav Nachman subscribes to that position of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. My Abi Allah, what is the din here? So Amar Rabbi Yaakov, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, bebayit shumim lo. Regards to a house, we listen to him, and he's allowed to take his stuff back because it was desolate before. The Baal Bayit paid nothing, asked for nothing, so this guy built it and he takes it away. He's just leaving the place the same way it was before he came to that position. B'sadeh, if he's in a field, ein shumim lo. We don't listen to him if it's a field. He goes into the field and plants the field and he says, you know what? I know you don't like this. I'm taking all my trees back. I'm leaving. So there we don't let him to take it back. B'sadeh, my time. Why by a field we not let him take his stuff back? Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. One possibility is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. The truth is that we would have known that already from Rabbi Yochanan before, who says that once trees are planted in Eretz Yisrael, you don't have a right to take them out. So this individual, even though he planted them without permission, and the Baal Bayit never paid him for them, nevertheless, he doesn't have a right now to take them out. The Baal Bayit will have to compensate him, but he doesn't have a right to take them back. Iga Damri, Yishum Kichasha Daro, because it weakens the land. That when you put up a structure on the land, it's not exactly true, but let's say begadol, it is true, which is that when you put up a structure, a bayit, you put it up, you take it down, nothing's changed in the land. Everything's the same from the time that you put it up to the time you take it down. You put it there, you remove it, nothing's changed. When you plant the trees in the land, the trees are growing and being sustained from the nutrition that is being provided by the land. When you pull out the trees afterwards, you're not going to give back the nutrients that those trees pulled from the land. So when you pull out the trees, you're not just pulling out the trees. You're pulling out the trees plus whatever they drew from the land. And that's why we don't allow you to do it. My ben ayu. What's the nafkamina between these two reasons? Ika ben ayu chutz la'aretz. The difference between them is whether this has application outside of Eretz Yisrael. If the din is mishum yishuv Eretz Yisrael, then the din would be applicable only in Eretz Yisrael. But if the din is Rishum Kichashad Ara, that would have an implication even outside of Eretz Yisrael, because it's a din, a monetary din, about your weakening the land or taking monetary value out of the land without compensating for it. Over here, it seems much harder to argue that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael means the Yishuv of Jewish property, because over here, the Gemara says that the Nafkamina is Chutz La'aretz. Now Tosfot asks, didn't we know this information already from Rabbi Yochanan? He says, yes, we knew that, but we need to give the other opinion, which is Kichashad Ara, that we have yet to hear about it. Aval El, Dafka Be'eretz Yisrael, and Shomlim Lo, Mishum Kichashad Ara, Lo Asab Yadayim, Elam Emela Yedei Shtifat HaNahar Naseh. So over there, in the previous case, it's only in Eretz Yisrael, in Shomlim Lo, Mishum De Kichashad Ara, Lo Asab Yadayim. He is not weakening the field intentionally, because the trees that left this field and went to the other field, It wasn't that he weakened the field that they were taken out of. It happened by a natural disaster or some sort of flooding that moved the trees. And so, what Tosfot says is that these two opinions are coming to tell you that, first of all, Kichasha D'Aro has application in Chutz Laretz. According to the one who says Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, he does not subscribe to Kichasha D'Aro and therefore has no application in Chutz Laretz. And number three is that the Kichasha D'Aro, we don't apply it in Eretz Yisrael where it happens to a natural disaster or natural means. Kichasha D'Aro is only when you uproot the tree and you're going to weaken the land that we say don't do it. But in a case where it happened because the flood came and washed the tree out of this land, we don't worry about this issue of Kichasha D'Aro. So those are the three new pieces of information that we got from this Braita that we wouldn't have had from the previous statement of Rabbi Yochanan. The Rosh here continues in Ot Chav Gimel and says that with regards to the question about the Balakarka, can he say to the individual, take your house and take all your materials off of here? He says the Gemara never addresses that. The question was posed to the Geonim, and the Rif brings from the Chuvata Geonim, that the Geonim say that it is a bilateral situation. That means that just like the individual has a right, according to the conclusion of the Gemara, to walk off with his Eitzim and Avanim, so too the Balabayit has a right to tell him, take your stuff and leave. On the other hand, the Ravid writes that one does not have a right to throw the individual off or to get rid of the house. And that is because the Ravid believes, Dein shomim lo, the kaimelon churva omedet livnot. Things that are desolate or destroyed are made to be built. Vizem maziku, Dein shomim lo, el yeshevo achiten yitziotav. The fact that this person did him a favor and put up a house and reestablished it, this guy's a mazik because he's just trying to throw the person off to get the property for free. And therefore, the builder's allowed to live in the house until the individual owns the karka compensates him for the building that was placed on it. Now that is the Ravid who assumes that places or churvot are places that are necessary to build, or one does build, and therefore similar to the Ramban by the case of the Sadeh, where he says if it's asui lita, that you don't have a right to refuse the individual's work and tell him to take it away. So too, the Ravid is saying this with regards to Binyan. Then the Rosh, the Shittato, who says before that even if it's a place that is a sui lita, you have a right to tell him to take your stuff off. So too, the Rosh here disagrees with the Ravid and says, Umistaver taima. He says that the Ravid only makes sense. Only an instance where the individual was not using that desolate or destroyed place. And that he should pay for this. Below kipuach parnasato. And he has sufficient means or funds to pay for it without diminishing or hurting his parnasa. Because then he's definitely trying to sneak his way out and get the house without having to pay for it. So the Rosh says, if it's a place that should be built, and it's ra'oi for this person to pay for it, he has the means by which to pay for it, then we will compel him to pay for it. In a case otherwise, the Rosh says he has a right to tell him, take your stuff off, I don't want the house that is built here. Okay, the next Mishnah. A maskir bayit l'chaveiro b'imot ha'geshamim. Someone rents out a property, a house to his friend during the winter season. Eino yochol yotzio, he doesn't have a right to evict him, min hachag vad Pesach. From Sukkot until Pesach, the Gemara will discuss why this is and what exactly the scenario is. Bimot hachama, if it's in the summertime, shloshim yom. He has 30 days. Ubi krachim, in the cities, achad yomot hachama v'chad yomot geshamim, whether it's summer or winter, shnei masar chodesh, 12 months. Ubi chaniyot, when we're talking about stores, Echad ayarot v'echad pirachim. Whether you're in the metropolis or whether you're in the smaller cities, 12 chodesh. You need 12 months. Shemgomei omer chanut shel nachtomim v'shel sabayim. If it is a baker's store or a dyer's store, shalosh shanim. Then it is 3 years. The Gemara will explain the reasons behind everything in this Mishnah. So I'm just going to leave the Mishnah as it is and we'll explicate on it now. Maishna yemot geshamim. Our assumption now, starting out in the Gemara, is that if you rent during the Mimot HaGeshamim, and you say to him, I'm renting it to you for the winter, then you get it for the whole winter. That's all the way from Sukkot until Pesach. Tichi agar inish beita b'Mimot HaGeshamim, agar l'kulu Mimot HaGeshamim. That when you rent something for the winter, it means you're going to rent it for the duration of the winter. Mimot HaChama Nami. Why don't you say the same thing about the summertime? When someone says, I'm going to rent it to you for the summer, they mean the entire summer. They don't just mean 30 days. They mean for the whole period of time. That's called Yimot HaChama, which really means from Pesach until Sukkot. Ella, that cannot be the explanation of our Mishnah. Bimot HaGeshamim, Hainu Taima. The reason in the wintertime it is, to lo shchiach beit al megar. It's very hard to find a new area to rent or a new facility to rent. So, based on that, you're not allowed to throw somebody out during the Yemot HaGeshamim. Our assumption now is that he rented from him stam. He rented from him without any indication as to the duration of the rental. And we'll see in a second that stam schirut is for 30 days. It's a 30-day schirut. If he, through this rental, that is a 30-day rental, continues to live there, and month after month he's paying the rent and living there based on the original rental price, then if it comes to be the middle of Yemot HaGeshamim, this guy does not have a fixed lease on this property. He simply has a month-to-month lease. What the Mishnah is saying is you can't kick him out during the Yemot HaGeshamim because he has no way to replace the rental that he has now. It's very difficult to find rentals during the winter, and therefore you can't throw him out. But that would mean Yemot HaChama, where he does have the ability to find a new piece of property, we would say that a rental for 30 days means 30 days, and he can terminate the lease at any point. At the end of any given month, he can terminate the lease and say, I am done. The Gemara has a problem with that because the next line in the Mishnah is, Eima Seifa. Bikrachim, in the big cities, Echad Yemot HaChama v'Echad Yemot HaGeshamim, whether it's the summertime or the wintertime, 12 Chodesh, 12 months. That makes it sound like your lease duration is automatically for 12 months. Whenever you rent it, the stam rental is for 12 months. But does that mean that if he ends the 12 months in the middle of the winter, mapikle, you can throw him out? Vamai! How can you throw him out there? There's nowhere to rent. So the Gemara now has, based on what we're explaining now, a difficulty in reconciling the Reisha and the Seifa. Because if you're talking about a stam rental, and it's telling us what the din is by a stam rental, which is that normal rentals are for 30 days. That's true in the summer. In the winter, yes, even though stam rentals are for 30 days, you can't throw him out because he has no way to replace it. If that's the case, then how do you explain the part about the cities? Well, in the cities, if it's for 12 months is the stam rental, that means at the end of the duration of the 12 months, you can toss him out, even though it lands in the middle of Yemot HaGeshamim. So then that doesn't reconcile with us saying that you can't throw people out, Yemot HaGeshamim. So Amar Rav Yehuda, the Odia Ketoni. So Rav Yehuda says, no, the Mishnah is talking about notice. How much notice do you need to give the individual in order for them to have to leave the property? Vachi Kamar. And this is what is meant by the Mishnah. Hamaskir by the Chavero Stam. Someone who rents out a property to the individual without any duration affixed to it. You may not evict him between Sukkot and Pesach during the rainy season. Unless you've informed him 30 days before, the way Rashi reads this means that from Tedvav Elul. From the 15th of Elul, you must already give him notice that you're going to evict him during the rainy season. As long as you've given him 30 days notice prior to the rainy season, you can then kick him out any time during the rainy season. On the other hand, once you've entered the rainy season, you cannot kick him out because you can't give sufficient notice to have him vacate the property. Tanya Nami Yochi, we have a brayta that supports that. Shamru Shloshim, Ukshamru Shtemasar Chodesh, Lo Amru Elo Hodio. You have to give him notice. So the 30 days here is notice. And the way that we're reading it as far as Yemot HaGeshamim is that you have to give notice 30 days before the winter season if you're going to evict them during the winter season. In the cities where it's tight and very hard to find housing, you have to give them 12 months notice. If you're going to evict them from the property, you have to give them 12 months notice. U'kashem shemaskir tzarich lo'odia, kach socher tzarich lo'odia. This is a two-way street. And just like the landlord needs to inform the renter of the fact that he was going to evict him, the renter must indicate that he will vacate the property and give him notice. Tamerlei, because the landlord can say to him, Io datan, if you informed me ahead of time that you were going to vacate, I would have found good renters to replace you. Meaning that I need time to find renters as well. So the same principle that applies to the landlord in giving notice to the renter has the same obligation to give notice to the landlord. So now we have one more qualification, and then we'll just speak about how Rashi explains this. Amar Rav Asi, Im nichnas yom echad b'imot ha'gshamim. If you go one day into winter, eino yachol otzio min ha'chag v'ad Pesach. Then you can't throw him out from Sukkot until Pesach. As Rashi says, lo diak tani, hanek shloshim yubet chodesh tani b'mitan lo diak amar. These are notices. Hamaspir bayit l'chaviro v'kalu yimei shirut b'imot ha'gshamim. He rented it for a certain duration, and the duration elapses during the Imot HaGshamim. Eino yachol lehotzio mishum delo shechichei batei. He can't throw him out at that point because there's no available housing. Elim kein hodio b'imot hachama shloshim yom. Unless he gave him notice 30 days before in the summertime, shlo yachiv lo zman, that he's not going to extend the lease. Mishiyach lezmano. So you have a lease that terminates in the Imot HaGshamim. What Rashi says is that even though the lease terminates then, he gets the ability to stay on, continuing to pay the lease at the current price until the end of the Imot HaGshamim, because it's impossible for him to find housing. If he give him notice 30 days before the Imot HaGshamim, meaning by Tetvav Elul, before Tetvav Elul, he gave him notice that when your lease expires and you go with the Shemim, I'm going to evict you, then he has a right to do that, because he gave him time during the summer season to find a replacement for when it terminates during the Imot HaGshamim. If your lease terminates in the middle of the summer, if the schirut ends in the middle of the summer, he has to give him 30 days notice. So the Raivin and the Rashba believe that during the summer you need no notice whatsoever, while Rashi and the Ramban believe you do need a minimum of 30 days of notice. If he's just on a regular lease, and the lease terminates in the summer, he has to give him 30 days notice before the end of the lease to tell him he's not going to renew the lease. If they let the lease lapse and he continues to live there month to month, he has to give him a month's notice in order to remove him from there. Ubikrachim, in the cities, you have to give him 12 months notice ahead of time. And if you don't give him notice, then the lease renews at the current terms. So it just continues to run at the current terms, month to month, because he has not given proper notice. So that's the way Rashi reads it. Rashi reads it that it has to do with a fixed lease that terminates b'imot HaGshamim, or a fixed lease that terminates b'imot HaChama. You can't evict the individual, tell him you're not going to renew the lease, unless you've given 30 days notice. For b'imot HaChama, that means 30 days notice before the end of the lease. In b'imot HaGshamim, it means 30 days before the b'imot HaGshamim starts, not anything to do with the end of the termination of the lease. That's Rashi. Many Rishonim disagree with one point in Rashi, which is that if you have a fixed lease, the Rif says that if it ends in b'imot HaGshamim, you're out, because you knew the term of the lease. Since you knew the term of the lease, if the term of the lease ends in the middle of b'imot HaGshamim, you're out then. What we're speaking about here is where the lease is already terminated, and the person is living there month to month. In the summer, you can give him 30 days notice. In the winter, you have to give him notice 30 days before the winter in order to tell him that you're not going to continue to renew it for him through the winter, or tell him whenever you're going to stop it during the winter. But if you have a fixed lease, then you don't have to give notice, because fixed lease, you know when the lease ends. So you don't have to give notice of no renewal, because there's no obligation to renew the lease. And that's the way many Rishonim learn, in disagreement with Rashi here, who says that if the lease terminates in the middle of the winter, then you can't throw him out unless you gave him 30 days notice before the winter started. And then Rav Asi's din is that if he's running on a month-to-month lease, as soon as he enters one day into Yemot HaGshamim, then that means that he gets to stay there for the entire Yemot HaGshamim. So that's the idea, that once you've entered into that zone is locked out from being evicted. And doesn't matter how much notice he gives him, he can't throw him out. So if his lease terminates, according to Rashi, one day into the winter, according to Rashi, he's there for the entire winter, unless you give him notice 30 days prior to Yemot HaChama. For the other Rishonim who think that a lease with a fixed term can throw him out anytime because it's a fixed term, or at least with 30 days notice, then in a case of 30-day renewals, as soon as he enters into Yemot HaGshamim, that means he has a right to stay there for the remainder of the Yemot HaGshamim, and there's no ability to give 30-day notice and have him leave at that point. Savana and Shloshim Yom Egnan. How can it be that Rav Asi says that if you go in one day into the winter season, then he's locked in for the whole winter season? We said in the Mishnah, it's 30 days. Hachi gamar. Im neus rachs yom echad bimot agshamim, mahan ish loshim yom, enu yachol otziyom min achag vada Pesach. If the 30 days notice, if you did it 29 days before the winter season, and therefore there's one day in the winter season, he's in there for the whole winter season. You didn't give him sufficient notice. So what the Gemara says about Rav Asi is that the notice must precede the Yemot Gshamim. If any period of that notice enters into the Yemot Gshamim, then you're there for the entire duration. Am Ravuna, im balara bot midabea mirabeh. If you want to raise the rent, he can raise the rent. If the term of the lease has expired, or he's running on a 30-day lease, which is renewing all the time, he's allowed to raise the rent. Amrali Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says, what type of idea is this? Hi, linketei bikovsei delishavkei liglima. The way that Rashi explains it over here is that he's got him by the testicles. What do you expect him to do? If a person is holding the other guy by his testicles, of course he's going to give up his cloak. So too over here. If the individual is in the house, he has no other options, and you raise the rent on him, what is he going to do? He has no way out. Why is that a fair practice? Mar says, lo tzricha diakar bate, that the market price went up. He does not have a right to raise the rent for no reason at all. He has to have a justification for raising the rent. A justification for raising the rent is that the cost of housing has gone up, the cost of rentals has gone up, and therefore he can maintain it at a market price. Rashi also qualifies it and says, shehefshedo nikar. It can't be just a diminished amount. It has to be a sufficient amount that the price that he is paying versus the market price, there is enough of a loss there or a visible loss that he's taking by renting it at below market. It's a couple of shekel, a couple of dollars below market. Again, here you have to figure out what that is. It's subjective. But even if it's 100 shekel, 200 shekel below market, that doesn't seem to be sufficient. It has to be a sodo nikar. It has to be a differential from the market price that is significant enough that gives him the right to raise it to market prices. But Rav Nachman says you can't give power to the landlord when you're saying that the person is stuck and then the landlord can demand any price. That's called extortion. And therefore he says that it has to be justified or has to be based on a market price. You can't simply raise prices at will. Right? The Gemara says, pshita, nafale beta, straightforward, we're about to say, now if the landlord's house fell down, amale lo adif minai, he can say to the renter, you're no better than I am. Which means that he basically can toss the renter out and say, I'm taking over because this is my house. I'm homeless and you are in a house. Now, if I boot you out, you're homeless and I'm not. I own the place, so I'm going to take it over. Rashi qualifies this and says, Ho'il v'giyazmano motzio. This is only after the termination of the duration of the lease. Rashi says that if he's in a lease, he has no right to kick him out. And it would be true if he prepaid for it. If he prepaid for the whole year, he doesn't have a right to kick him out, according to Rashi. Because he says, the reason that you're staying here at this point is not because you have a lease, but because you are continuing. I haven't given you notice to get out. But at this point, I was thrown out without notice as well, which this was unforeseen. If it's a foreseeable circumstance, we can demand that the landlord give him notice and throw him out. But the landlord is now found in an unforeseen predicament, and therefore, he can also have the renter kicked out in an unforeseen basis. He doesn't have a demand of notice, and he can throw him out. If you look here on the Daf Kuf Bet Amud Bet, the Bali and Tosafot there at the bottom say the following. A renter is afraid to pay up front for the whole year. Penny pol abayit, because maybe the house will fall down. Oy pol beitosha maskir, or the landlord's house will fall down. Yotziano, you can throw him out. From the Balei of Tosafot, it sounds like even if you have not reached the end of a lease, even if you're in the middle of a lease, even if you prepaid for the property, the landlord has a right to evict you from this property. Rashi says over here, it's only at the end of a lease where it's going on an evergreen basis and he's just renewing month to month based on the old lease, then you have a right to throw him out because he's not under any contractual obligation or he hasn't prepaid for it. On the other hand, for the Balei Tosafot, it's irrespective of those items. Even if he's under lease, even if he's prepaid for it, the landlord has a right to evict the renter and put himself in there because he's in an unforeseen predicament and therefore notice is not of meaning. But even a contractual obligation, this is almost like force majeure, where it was an event totally out of his control. And therefore, he can evict the tenant and breach the contract in order to put himself into the property. Obviously, there's a big difference between Rashi and the Balei HaTosafot. So now the Gemara continues. So that's Pshita, that he has a right to do that. Zavnei, if the landlord sold it to a third party, or Orte, Horish, he gave it over b'yirushah to someone. Oh yeah, veiv matana, or gave it as a gift to another party. Amar lei, the socher, the renter, can say to the new owner, lo adif mi gavra datet minei. You are no better than the landlord that sold it to you. Meaning that the rights that you acquired are the same rights the landlord had. And just like the landlord didn't have a right to evict me without notice, so too you don't have a right to evict me without notice. Because you bought the landlord's rights in the property, and your rights will not exceed his rights. And therefore, I can stay in the property until you give me proper notice. Klalalei the brave. But in a situation where he married off his son, Chazinan, if it was a foreseeable event that his son was going to get married, then he has to give notice to the renter. Because now he needs the house for his son, for the new couple. And therefore he has to give notice to them that he's going to evict them or terminate the lease in order to put his son into this property. So if he had enough notice, he should have given the socher notice. Filo, if it was a sudden thing or the shidduch came about very quickly, amalei lo adif minai. Then the owner can say to the socher, you know better than me, just like this was an unforeseen event, and I couldn't have known about it, therefore I'm not obligated to provide you with the same notice, and he can bump him out in order to utilize it for his own family. How gavra dezaman arba dechamra? An individual purchased a boat full of wine that he was shipping. Lo ashkach duchta lo tevei. He had no place to store the wine. It reached the shore. They were unloading it on the dock. He had nowhere to store it. Amar la lahayitata. He found a woman who had storage, warehouse space. And he says to her, itlach duchta lo grei. Says to her, do you have property or space to rent out? Amar la lo. She said, no, I have no space available. I have nothing available for you to use. Azal kadsha. He went ahead and became engaged to her halakhically. Meaning that he offered her his hand in marriage. Yavale duchta la'ayale. Then all of a sudden there was space that she had that she could provide for him. So she gave him space to put his barrels in. Azal the beite. The guy, after getting this storage space from the woman, went home. Kotav lagita. He wrote her a bill of divorce. Shadarla. And sent it to her from his house. So obviously, he was using the woman. He only married her to get the space to store his wine. And so as soon as he got home, he sent her a divorce because he never intended to go through with the marriage. Azlei, this woman was a sharp tack. Agra shokolai, she hired schleppers or haulers, minei ubei, and paid them out of the wine that was stored there. Afikte, and then she had them remove the wine from her property, v'otvei b'shvila, and threw it out onto the street. She just emptied out the warehouse, put it out on the street, and left it as his problem. Amar Avuna b'rei d'Rav Shua, kasher asah, ken yaseh lo. The way that he behaved, that's the way we'll behave towards him. Gmulo yeshuv b'rosho. What was coming to him landed on his head, and he got what he deserved. Lo mibayi chatzer d'lo kaima la'agro. And not only in a case where it's a chatzer that was not available for rent, and so therefore when she gave him the property, it was clearly connected to the kiddushin. Ela afilu chatzer the kaim la'agra, even if it is a property that is available for rent, amrelei, she can say, l'kuli ama nechali l'agrire, I'm willing to rent it to anyone else, v'lechalo nechali, but I have no interest in renting it to you. Derami dalai ke'arya arba, because I look at you as a lion in wait. Meaning that what you've done is so distasteful, and you are, in a sense, a conniving, cunning person who does things in underhanded ways, I have no interest in renting it to you. And she has a right to say that and toss all of this stuff out. And the Poskim bring this down not simply as a spirit of the law, but as the letter of the law. That because he acted in an underhanded manner, then the right thing to do to him is penalize him in this way and have his stuff thrown out. And the woman's actions are justified, and we would even advise her to do such if she came to us and told us the story. To me, that it's a ikar halocha, not just, okay, she did it, he got what he deserved. No, he's going to get what he deserves because he acted in an underhanded and conniving manner. Right now, Shimon Omer shel nachtomim v'shel tzabaim shalosh shanim. So when it comes to stores, we said in the Mishnah that you have to give 12 months notice for stores. And for these particular items, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says for bakers and for dyers that they need 3 years of notice. Tana mipnei shehekefan mirubeh. It's because they have large credit outstanding. So Rashi on the Mishnah explains this based on the Gemara. The reason you have to give 12 months notice for a storekeeper is because a storekeeper sells on credit. And the way that he collects the credit is that people, as they get money, come by the store and pay him back. If he moves locations, the people who owe him the money are not going to know where to pay him back. So we have to give him time to unwind all of his credit that's there. So in a normal store, we would tell him that it takes 12 months to unwind, and therefore you have to give him 12 months notice. When you're talking about a baker, or you're talking about a dyer, over there, the cost of work is higher, and therefore their credit extended is larger. And it takes them a longer duration to collect the credit, and therefore you have to give them 3 years in order for them to wind down the credit that they've extended to parties. So that's why you have to give them more notice. That's the way Rashi learns. On the other hand, I think that the easier way to read this, and the Miria brings down a shita like this, is that when it comes to a nachtom, a baker and a dyer, they have to invest in setting up the store. They have to put in ovens. They have to do things that require infrastructure changes in the store. So in order for them to gain the benefit of their investments, you have to give them much longer notice. First of all, to set up somewhere else in a proper manner, but also to give them a return on their investment. When they rent it from you, you have to give them a minimum amount of time so that what they invested and put into the store will produce profits for them. And that's what it means, mipnei hekefan mirubeh, means that their outlays are heavy, that their investment in the store is heavy, and therefore you have to give them time to recoup the investment they made in the store. Okay, now next Mishnah, again, having to do with rentals. Maskir bayit lechavero, person who rents a house to his friend. Maskir chayav, the person, the landlord who's renting it out, is responsible to put in a dalet, a door. Binagar, a pin lock, something that inserts into the ground that locks the door. Ubimanol, a regular locking system. Ubichol davar shemaseh uman, anything that requires a craftsman to do it. Aval davar sheinu maseh uman, hasucher oseyu, anything that is not a craftsman's work, then it's the obligation of the renter to take care of it. The basic difference that we would look at, in the Gemara you're going to see it's not perfect, is that things that have to do with the infrastructure or the structure of the house itself, we would assume that the landlord takes care of that. Anything that has to do with the livability of the house, that the socher does. Another way to say it is that anything that has to do with the basics of the house, then the landlord has to provide it. Anything that is a convenience to the renter, then the renter has to take care of it himself because that's a convenience. Hazevel shel balabayit. The zevel belongs to the balabayit. Here the Gemara will explain this, so we're going to leave that till the Gemara. Ve'en esocher ela yotzei min ha'tonur min yakaryayim bilvad. The ashes produced by the stoves and the ovens, that belongs to the renter, because in a sense, he's the one producing it. He's utilizing the kelim that are there. He's the one baking and cooking on the ovens and on the stove. And therefore, the ashes that are produced there, which they used also for fertilizer, those belong to the renter. Tan Rabbanan, ha-maskir by the chavero, maskir chayav lamido daltot, liftoach lo chalunot. So daltot is similar to our mission of doors. Over here, the brayta adds, in addition to that, he has to open up windows for him. Whether that means that he has to frame out windows that exist so that they can be closed, or if there's not sufficient light, he has to open up windows, actually carve out holes that there are windows. The chazeklo atikra, he has to strengthen the ceiling, meaning that if it's a two-floor house, then he has to strengthen the floorboards to make sure that they are secure and that the upper floor is fine. The smochlo kura, the cross beams that are supporting the house and the upper floor, if any of those break, he has to fix them. These are the responsibilities of the renters. Lasod lo sulam, to make a ladder to get up to the second floor. That's the equivalent of a staircase to enter the second floor. In their day, they didn't have a staircase. They had a ladder to ascend to the second floor. So that, even though that seems to be infrastructure related, since it's a matter of convenience how you get up there, the socher provides his own ladder to get up there. Lasod lo makeh, on the roof, he has to make a makeh, a fence around the roof. If there's any space where there's a possibility of someone falling off, then he has to put up a fence around it. Lasodo marzeif, he has to put up the gutters. Vilhatiach et gago, and to plaster the roof. So these are items that today we would consider to be the obligations of the landlord because they are infrastructure related. As Rashi notes over here, Lasodo marzeif is not a masei uman. In their day, he says that the roofs were slanted in all four directions, and the water ran off. In order to prevent the water, when it was running off, from dropping directly down and ruining the foundations of the walls, they used to put a piece of wood there that used to direct the water away from the house. So that's something, if that wood fell down, or if there's no wood there, anybody can put up that piece of wood just to direct the water away from the house. If it was a more formal type of marzeiv, maybe gutter, which is a, maybe a maseuman, over there, that might be the obligation of the maskir of the landlord. Latiach et gago seems to be that that was a seasonal thing that they did, that every winter season you had to reinforce the roof and make sure that it was sealed. And so that's something that's an obligation of the person living there rather than simply the landlord's obligation because it's something that happens every year on a seasonal or cyclical basis. Bo minei Rav Sheshet, mezuzah al mi. Who has the obligation to put up the mezuzah? It says, mezuzah? Why do you have a question? Amar Rabbi Shashia, mezuzah chuvat adarhi. That mezuzah is the obligation of the person residing in that location. And the Gemara in Menachot darshins from Tava Mamezuzot Peitecha, Peitecha Biatcha. And that means the one who enters the house, the one who's regularly traversing the threshold of the house, they are obligated in putting up the mezuzah. And it makes it chuvat adar, the obligation of the person that resides in the house is obligated to put up the mezuzah. So the truth is that it is a machloket in the Rishonim as to whether that obligation on the socher, on the renter, is really something that is a deal right though. And we'll see in a second why. Ela mekom mezuzah al mi. It's not a question about who has to put up the mezuzah. It's a question of making the space for the mezuzah. The assumption being that the way that you put up a mezuzah is the way that you see it in Yerushalayim today, is that they carved an etch into the stone itself, and then they inserted the cloth into that etching in the stone. So the question is, the makom mezuzah, that which is a work of a craftsman, who has to do that? So amar Rav Sheshet, tinu tua. That's our Mishnah. Davar she'in masei uman, disocher oseyu. V'ay nami la masei umanu. This is also not something that an uman has to do. The efshar hu begufta dekanya, because you have the ability to put it up there in a hollow reed. So here is a halacha that is important, which is that there are two ways to affix a mezuzah. One way to affix a mezuzah is to carve into the doorpost itself and insert the cloth into the doorpost. That is a masei uman. And that was the havamina of the Gemara, that the landlord would be responsible to provide that etch to put the mezuzah in because that's a masei uman. The answer of Rav Sheshet is no, because you have the ability to affix the mezuzah to the door through a casing, putting it into a reed, and then affixing it to the door. From here, we conclude that it is a valid way to affix a mezuzah to a door if you put it into a casing. Although it is quoted in the name of the Gra, that the Gra said that the proper way to affix a mezuzah is to etch it into the door itself, or to the doorpost itself, and not a gufta kanya. This Gemara is very difficult for that position of the Gra. The way to possibly reconcile with the Gra is it depends on the material of the casing that you're putting up. And that the Gra might say that it's better to put it in the doorpost itself when the object that you're going to affix to the door is not the same material. Which means over here, what was made out of reeds, which is a wood, and you're affixing it to a wood doorpost, that's fine because min bemino is not mafsik. On the other hand, if you were to use some other material to encapsulate the mezuzah and then affix it to the doorpost, then you would have a hefsek because the material is not the same material as the doorpost. Or in essence, what the Gra wants is either the mezuzah is placed into the doorpost itself, or if you affix it to the doorpost, you want something that's going to be batel to the doorpost, which means that it is the same material as the doorpost. That might explain the reasoning of the Gra, but again, the poskim in general say that based on our Gemara, you're allowed to affix a mezuzah to a door in a casing. which is the way that many people do it today, the Balei HaTosafot over here make an interesting point. And they say that Mikan Nira, Kemosh Perish Rashi. Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam have a machloket about a statement in the Gemara Minachot, which says that you're not allowed to put up a mizak and min nagar. Not allowed to put it up like a nagar. It's not clear what nagar means over there. Rashi says, kamin nagar, you're not allowed to put up the mezuzah on a horizontal basis. You can't have the mezuzah laying down. The Rabbeinu Tam says, no, it means you can't put the mezuzah standing up. Here, Tosafot brings a proof as to why the Rabbeinu Tam thinks that way. Now, the reasoning behind each of them is the following. Rashi says that you put the mezuzah on the door upright, the same way that the Sifrei Torah are kept in the Aron HaKodesh, which is that they are upright. When you store Sifrei Torah in the Aron, you put them in upright. So too the mezuzah should be upright on the doorpost. The Rabbeinu Tam says, no. The way that you put the mezuzah on the door is the same way that you read the Sefer Torah. When you read the Sefer Torah, you lie it on the bima. So too, the mezuzah on the doorpost should be laid down. Therefore, the Balei HaTosafot and Minachot come up with this compromise solution, which is to put the mezuzah on an angle, which is our practice that has brought down the Ashkenazim, which is to put the mezuzah on an angle. That way you're mekayim both the Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam. The truth is, you're not mekayim either of them. Rashi thinks that the mezuzah should be standing, and Rabbeinu Tam seems to be flat, laying down. So how, by putting on an angle, do you accomplish both of them? So the explanation has to be that Rashi doesn't say that the mezuzah has to be standing. He says it just can't be laying down. And the Rabbeinu Tam doesn't say that the mezuzah has to be laying down. It just can't be upright. So then when you put it on an angle, you have then avoided either one of those issues. And that's what the practice of the Ashkenazim is today, is to put up a mezuzah on the angle, unless there's no ability to put up on an angle, and then we would follow Shita Rashi and put it upright. Both the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch paskin like Rashi, that you put the mezuzah on upright, and therefore the Bnei Sfarad, the Sfaradim, following the psak of the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, put their mezuzah out straight upright. And the truth is, l'shita tam, they are consistent. Because the reason Rabbeinu Tam says that you lay the mezuzah down is because you read the Torah laying down. But for the Sfaradim, who put the Torah away standing up and read it standing up, it makes sense that their mezuzah should be standing up. And that is the practice of the Sfaradim. But here, the Balei HaTosafot say that the fact that you're putting it into a hollow reed to affix it to the door seems to support Rashi's position. I'm not sure I clearly understand why Tosafot says this, but he says that if you have to put it upright on the door, you need something to hold the mezuzah. It won't stay on there. Whereas if you laid it down, you could have put it on there without using an attachment or fixture. It's not clear to me why that is. Maybe because there are crevices or there are ledges along the way and you could put it on there. So maybe there's spacing between the boards or places that you could put the mezuzah that you wouldn't need a casing for. But he says here, this favors the Shita of Rashi that you should put it up upright because of the casing. Tosafot says, for the Rabbeinu Tam, why do you need the holder at all? So in the end he says it's to protect it from moisture or from the elements, meaning that if you put it in there without a cover, that's why according to the Rabbeinu Tam you would need it, even though you could insert it without having to put a cover on it. The Yerushalmi disagrees with our Gemara and says that the proper way to affix the mezuzah is to put it into the doorpost, and since it's a Masei Uman, it's actually the obligation of the Maskir to put up the mezuzah, at least make the space for where the mezuzah is. That might actually affect a machloket in the Mishonim. The Balei HaTosafot, as well, not here, in other places in Shas, and the Rashi over here say that the obligation of a renter to put up a mezuzah is only a din derabbanan and not a din d'oraita. That truthfully, the din d'oraita is that the Baal HaBayit, the owner of the house, is the one that should put up the mezuzah. Midrabanan, we obligate the socher, the renter, or the person that lives there to put it up because he is the beneficiary of the fact that there is a mezuzah there because it's a protection for those residents who live there at the time. And so therefore, midrabanan, we obligate him to put it up. But had he been a socher, just a renter, Balei HaTosafot in one place speculate that maybe he's not chayav at all in mezuzah as a socher, and that the Rabbanan imposed that he put up a mezuzah. Or you can argue that it might be the obligation, like Yerushalmi, of the maskir, and that the socher, midrabanan, we flip the obligation over to the renter. Other Rishonim say from our Gemara, it's clear, or the way that the Gemara Menachot phrases it, is that it's chovat adar means that midoraita. Whoever's living there is obligated to put up a mezuzah, and that doesn't matter whether you are a renter or the owner of the house, whoever's living there is required to put up a mezuzah. So Tan Rabbanan, we're just going to leave off here with an important deer. A maskir by the chavero, ala socher la solo mezuzah. Obviously, the conclusion from this is Gemara and Psachim as well, because it's kovat adar, which is that whoever rents the house is obligated to put up the mezuzah. Kshu yotzei, when he leaves the place, lo yitzlenu biyado biyotzei. He may not take the mezuzah when he leaves. Umi nachri notla biyado biyotzei. On the other hand, if the landlord is not Jewish, or the new tenants are not going to be Jewish, he can take the mezuzah with him. Umaseh bechad shenatla biyado. And there was an incident where somebody took the mezuzah that was supposed to be left there, biyatzah, and he left for kavari shto shtei banav, and he buried his wife and his two children. It says, maseh lishtor. You said he doesn't have to leave it when it's a goy. The story is going back on the reisha. It was a Jewish landlord. There were Jewish tenants coming in, and he took the mezuzah, and therefore he was punished for that. Now the Balei Tosafot over here say, why can't he take the mezuzah with him? We have a principle of Shmuel that's brought in the Gemara Menachot and other places, that one is allowed to be matir tzitzit mi beged the beged. That if you have a beged that's tzitzit on it, you're allowed to take the tzitzit off this beged, put on another beged, and wear the other beged. There's no obligation to leave the tzitzit on a particular beged. So why over here is an obligation to leave the mezuzah behind? So Tosafot says, the fee, shemazakim bayim babayit sheim bo mezuzah. Because there are problems for houses that don't have mezuzah, mazikim enter the house. So from here, you have this idea that is noted in the Gemara, but really takes flight after the Gemara in the Geonim and the Rishonim, that mezuzah is there for protection. That not only is a mezuzah there as a reminder, which is what it seems to be in the Psukim, that the mezuzah is there to remind you and for you to think about Hashem every time you enter and exit the house. So it's not there for the protection of the house, but rather for the person himself who passes through the doorway to remember or think about something the same way like when you have tefillin on. It has an impact on the individual, but it has to do with you need to think or be affected by the tefillin that are on you. So mezuzah, the same thing. But nevertheless, the Gemara does seem to indicate, and the Rishonim play on this, that there is a protection afforded by the mezuzah from mazikim. And so therefore, Tosfot says, if he pulls off the mezuzah, it's as if he's mazik biyadayim, the people are going to come to live in the house afterwards. Because he's allowing the mazikim to come in by removing the mezuzah. So what turns out from this is that there is an obligation, mitzad yoredeya, to leave your mezuzah on the door when you leave the house. The heter to take it off is when the upcoming tenants are not going to treat it properly. Then that can be for one of two reasons. That can either be because they're not Jewish, or the landlord's not Jewish, or if they're going to paint the house, or do a work in the house. Because when the painters come in, they don't know what the mezuzah is. They paint straight over it, or they ruin the mezuzah when they take it off, or they're going to take it off to paint. In those instances, then you might have a right to take the mezuzot down. The second thing is that there's a choshen mishpat aspect to this. They are your mezuzot. So then, if you're going to leave the house and leave the mezuzot there, the tenant coming in is benefiting from your mezuzot. So they should have to pay you for the mezuzot. So that is true. You can ask the new tenant who's coming in to pay for the mezuzot. If they refuse to pay for the mezuzot, if you have higher quality mezuzot on the door, you can take those off and replace them with lower quality mezuzot. Because your obligation mitzad yoredeya is to leave mezuzot on the wall. It's not to leave mezuzot that are mehudar on the wall. It's not to leave the best quality mezuzot on the wall. It's just to leave mezuzot. And so therefore, mitzad yoredeya, you can discharge your obligation with the basic mezuzah or anything that is bidiavad you'd be yotze with. If the tenant wants to reimburse you for the higher quality mezuzot that you put up, that you can make a demand for because that's a choshen mishpat issue. So it is clear that you should, if you're going to leave the mezuzot, inform the party. If they are higher quality or expensive mezuzot, then you can offer them to buy them off of you. If they don't want to buy them, then you can downgrade them to lower quality mezuzot and take your mezuzot from the door. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuvbet Amud Aleph.